Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. We're very excited to announce that we are changing our name to Wild Heart Meditation Center. You can stay subscribed to the podcast as you currently are, or if you choose to join us again at a later date in the future, just remember to search wherever you get your podcasts for Wild Heart Meditation Center. We're excited to be introducing new facilitators to our group and expanding our presence in our local community. Enjoy. So the format on Sunday night, if you're new, is we'll usually meditate and then I'll introduce a topic or a theme and I'll share on that for a while. And then we'll have an opportunity for some open discussion. And the purpose of the Dharma talk, really there are a few. It can be aimed to inspire. It can be aimed to educate. It can be aimed to tell a story, to personalize some of the teachings that the Buddha offered. And all of these things have one thing in common, which is really, it's an opportunity to kind of reflect. You know, and this is how human beings really share wisdom, is through language. So the Buddha always encouraged people that practiced the Dharma, his teaching, to reflect inwardly. I think the word's opanayako, which means to really to come and to see for ourselves what resonates. So that's always the encouragement when we, you know, come in here, is to, in a way, honor our own unique human experience and to watch the Dharma come alive in our own lives, to see that it's kind of already here. That's another thing that the Buddha says, is the Dharma is immediate and visible. And so, you know, one thing that I talk about and I think is useful in our Western world is that the Buddha's Dharma, the teachings, are not so much dogmatic. They're not so much a belief system as they are a map of experience. The word Dharma means the way things are, which could sound a little arrogant if you think about it as like a dogma. It's like, all right, this dude, I guess, has things figured out. He knows the way things are and he's about to tell us. You know, but really what the Dharma is it's a series of perspectives on matters of perception and intention, perspectives on living with ethics in the world and how we speak and act and make a living. It's perspectives on how we meditate and how we illuminate the mind and our reactive habits of mind and how we find more ease in alleviating the stress of the mind. So the Dharma is just perspectives that are shared perspectives that I think we all have experience with. And tonight I want to talk about the topic of faith, which is a kind of, for me, it's a little bit of a dirty word. This is one of the things in spiritual tradition in general that I continually struggle with. I call it the F word sometimes. And because Buddhism is beyond beliefs, you know, faith is such an interesting thing to investigate. It's like, how do we, or why do we develop faith in a path that's mostly self-exploratory, that's introspective? You know, why would we want that, and what does it mean to have that? The Buddha said himself, he's only interested in two things. He's not interested in metaphysics, the nature of existence. He's not interested in objective, ultimate reality, what exists out here, where we go when we die, right? These kind of questions. He's interested in what causes suffering in our lives and what leads to the end of suffering. And so the Dharma is not really asking us to have a belief in something that we can't experience. It's not asking us to have faith in a being or an entity beyond what we can comprehend. It's not asking us to look outside of ourselves for our salvation. That the Buddha says really all that we need to end suffering is in us. It's already here. Yet, faith is a central aspect of the Buddha's teaching. It's a practice. It's like rather than having faith in, it's about looking through the lens of faith. Like, how do I find motivation, aspiration? How do I find connection with the direction of my path and my practice? Where am I going? And how do I get there? There are a few reasons why I think faith is important. And these four that I've kind of reflected on is one, is faith helps with our attitude. Without it, we fall into cynicism, pessimism, doubt, negativity, nihilism. I believe, this is my own opinion, that Buddhism without faith is nihilism. If we just look at suffering and the causes of suffering, and we see this reality of birth, aging, sickness, and death as a reality all of us have to live, and we're stuck in that reality, and all we can do is just try to suffer less about those facts, sounds pretty nihilistic to me. we can often, in a practical way, I know for me, I get caught in this critical, cynical, negative view of life a lot of the time. And faith helps with our attitude. It helps to lift the mind. Faith also offers us direction. Without it, we don't have a direction out of feeling stuck. So when I feel depressed, the mind gets covered in the kind of cobweb of hopelessness and despair. Faith is that sense of, maybe there's a way out. It's an attitude, and then it's also helping us to kind of look for that way. Well, where's the direction? What are some things that I can have faith in to help pull me out? And faith also is a form of motivation. It's kind of can be the fire under my ass sometimes to say, it can be like almost encouragement, like when someone says, I have faith in you, right? Or that kind of encouraging, inspiring, there's that type of faith. And faith, I think most importantly, is also about perseverance, is that when things get hard, we keep going. And no matter what, we don't give up. We keep going. And this is, for me, a beautiful quality of faith, that when it would be easier to be harsh or easier to be dishonest, when it would be easier to kind of give in to my more base instincts and drives, faith has that sense of, sticking to integrity. And having like almost this belief in living with integrity. In the Buddhist context, the word faith, this is this Pali Sanskrit term, sada, which actually means something more like confidence. And from a Buddhist perspective, oftentimes the way that the Buddha refers to this word sada is that once we live with integrity and mindfulness, and we take a path of spiritual practice, as we walk the path, we start to see the benefit. And as we start to see the results, the fruit of our walking the path, we build confidence in it. And I think we've all had experiences like this, where we maybe take a leap of faith and we try something new. And in the beginning, there's all this uncertainty and doubt about whether we're on the right path, or, you know, whether we're doing it right, whether we're going in the right direction. And then we get little bits of wisdom along the way that reassure us. And that's often how the Buddha refers to faith, is his experienced faith, not blind faith. In my experience, faith through experience is the foundation of faith for me. It's what kind of makes me feel like I have a ground. You know, especially at this point, because I've been doing this practice for a few years, so it's when things get shaky, when I start to doubt myself, when I start to, you know, become overcome with hopelessness or despair, when I start to feel like I'm losing touch with my purpose, when I'm going through major life transitions, what I lean on is my experience. I reflect. And the Buddha encourages us to do this too, to reflect on times when you don't have faith, to reflect on times when you did. And I remember being someone that came to this practice through the suffering, the mental suffering of depression, feeling completely like the wind was taken out of my sail, and just remembering, having like a hint of this acknowledgement that I knew that I didn't always feel that way. Even though my mind told me, you know, would always tell me that I did. I call it the three voices of depression. I've always felt this way. I'm always going to feel this way. I'm the only one that feels this way. During those times, I would reflect, and I would, with mindfulness, look at my mind, and I would say, that's not true. My faith eludes me in this moment. Like, I don't have it, but I know I have had it. You know, and that's really powerful, and it's something that, you know, maybe I don't have an everyday awareness of, but experienced faith is foundational. And so here's the good news, is that whether we're coming through this path or another path or no path, if you're a human and you're living and breathing, you have experience. So you know you can get through some shit. If you're sitting in this room, you've gotten through some shit, right? Some of us more than others. And so we can have faith. There's something in that, that we can get through more shit. You know, we can persevere. We can, you know, we ended up here. So I think that faith through experience is foundational, but I think there are a couple problems with only that. And one is, it's hard to have faith in something that you haven't done yet. And so if we're talking about new experiences, trying something new, getting out of our comfort zone, you know, coming here tonight, you know, or trying to practice meditation or starting something new, it's hard to really have faith through experience because you don't have the experience. And so the reason why this is problematic is that sometimes I lean a little bit too much on my experience. And I'm rest in what's comfortable because it's familiar, because I have faith in it, because it works. And it can limit us, I think, from going beyond our comfort zone and kind of stepping out into something new. The other problem with just having faith through experience is that, like I said before, we don't always feel it. Like, faith is an action, I think, first and foremost, but it's also confidence is a feeling. Right? So we don't always have confidence. And so if we just kind of are looking for and looking towards our experience to fulfill our faith, to carry on, to keep going, if we just kind of rely on that, you know, we don't always have that access. We don't always have that feeling. We don't always have that sense that, you know, we can do it. Especially in the moments, they call these the dark night of the soul moments, when things get really wobbly, you know, when we get on thin ground. These moments often happen during times of transition in life, where we go from an identity, we lose that identity, and we haven't yet formed a new identity. And this is the Buddha's teaching on not self, is that we're always, you know, we have many identities. Ourselves are changing, our roles are changing, is another way to put that, simple way to put that. And so when our roles change, you know, we lose an old identity, a friend group, a job, a career path, you know, when we lose touch with that, you know, faith is hard to access because we haven't been here before. We don't feel it. And the third, and I think my favorite reason that experiential faith doesn't quite cover all the bases for me, is that when we just base our faith on our experiences, we don't aim high. So I actually think there's a benefit in believing like things, believing in things like, or aiming for things like enlightenment and awakening. I don't know if it really exists or what that even means, but I think the mystery of that is the point of it. I don't know or care if awakening's possible. I don't think, and I know the Buddha, and we can, you know, give in other talks on awakening. I don't want to go too far into it, but the Buddha definitely did not feel like awakening, from his perspective, was a mystical, special experience. So this is just what I would call faith in the form of aspiration, of going beyond the limitations of the present, of improving, of getting better, of, you know, continuing to work harder, to persevere, because we wouldn't do that if we didn't think it was possible. We would stop growing if we didn't think we could keep growing. And so, you know, whether we believe in awakening or enlightenment is besides the point. We'll talk about this later. But the point is that we want to shoot for the stars. Even if we can't reach them, even if they're thousands and thousands and thousands of light years away, even if the stars are already burnt out, the ones that we're looking at in the sky, because they're so far away. You know, why not, you know, why not incline in that direction? And this is the basis of, I think, every spirituality and every religious tradition, really, is there's these you know, is the aspiration to awaken. And so how do we connect in a practical way with faith? I think we can connect through experience, but I think we can also connect through ritual, through symbols, ceremony. And we don't talk about this a lot here, and that's why I kind of wanted to. I consider this center mostly a secular Buddhist center, meaning we don't do often that much chanting or too much ritual or ceremony. And that's by and large for a practical reason, because we aren't culturally immersed in the Buddhist context in which all of these teachings came through. And I feel that the Buddha was gracious enough to not himself talk about forms of ritual and ceremony. Mostly the cultural traditions that Buddhism found itself in later were the ones that inserted the ritual and ceremony. So you have Thai rituals and ceremony, and Burmese ritual and ceremony, and Tibetan ritual and ceremony, and Japanese, and they're all different. And so in our culture, we don't, you know, we could stand and sing hymns together and have someone playing an organ. That might be kind of rad, right? But that would probably freak people out too, right? And so we tend to have a secular demographic. We're a secular people here in the West. So we teach in that format. But how do we connect with aspiration and intention and motivation? How do we stay inspired? How do we connect with something that isn't tangible in the moment? How do we keep going when it's hard to keep going? We need to be reminded. We need some sign, some symbol. In neuroscience, this is the role of the right brain. Our right brain makes sense of the world through symbols and imagery and emotion, right? It's not organized. It's not linear. It's felt. And so the right brain sees the Buddha sitting in the light. You know, there's something luminous about that. There's something, you know, if you're a Buddhist, that could be beautiful about that. There's something inspiring about that. I like to, when before I teach, I just like to sit and kind of take a moment to look up. Not because I'm worshiping that man. I don't even know if that man was real or if it was a man or what that was, right? But this ideal of the Buddha, which is just means wake up. Bud means to awaken. The Buddha is the one who is awakened. So Buddhism means wake up-ism. And this is a symbol. There's a utility to spirituality in this way, of having some kind of form, having some kind of structure and some type of, hallmarks for connecting. In Buddhism, we have three hallmarks, the refuges, the three refuges of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. I love the word refuge. You know, the refuge means a safe dwelling place. And so much of what the Buddha talks about is this world we live in is vulnerable. You know, that there's this groundlessness to this existence that we can't quite predict what's going to happen next. We can't quite know what the future holds. You know, we can influence our lives, but by and large, the majority of the things that happen to us, around us, are beyond our control. We can influence, we have some agency, but we live in an existence that's fragile in a way. It's vulnerable, right? And we're just exposed to that. And so where do we find some ground? Or how do we feel safe in an existence that can feel overwhelming? So the three refuges represent this kind of, these symbols of safety. And the first one I want to start with is actually the symbol of Sangha. And Sangha means community. One of the Buddha's attendants, Ananda, is one of these people in the suttas. It's funny. He's like one of these people, you know, that's like kind of a know-it-all, like a brown nose, like in class, always raising their hand. And Ananda, it's funny because in the discourses, he would always think he knew something and would go up and ask the Buddha, and he'd say, I know what you were talking about now. And he would just kind of list off his synopsis of the Buddha's teaching. And always the Buddha would say, not so. He basically, Ananda was wrong like every time he came to the Buddha. And one of the times he came to the Buddha, he said, I get it. He said, I realize you talk about the Sangha, which is just means community, this community. Right? He says, you talk about this community so much. He said, it's like half of your teaching. It's that important. And the Buddha said, not so, Ananda, not so. He said, the Sangha is the whole of my teaching. And the Buddha believed that we can't really wake up, grow, transform, heal, recover, whatever word you want to use, alone. And it's interesting because if you look at the psychology behind this, that the emotional, empathetic centers of our brain are wired to the empathetic, the emotional regulation centers of the brain are wired to the empathetic centers of our brain. So we regulate emotions in community, in tribe, in relationship. We're born and wired to do that. Because as an infant, you won't live without connecting with a caregiver. Your caregiver doesn't have any need to take care of you once they birth you if they didn't have empathy and these mirror neurons and this sense of... So that's born in. Our care and concern for one another is born in. I think that's pretty cool. And so we heal together as a tribe. We work together, the Homo sapiens especially. Like this is our kind of our thing. It's our specialty. This is what we specialize in, tribalism. You know, it's why, fortunately, thanks to you all, I'm not here by myself, just meditating. And so we take refuge in one another. And to be honest, I don't really care, you know, whether it's a Buddhist community, a Christian community, a community that practices Islam, it's, you know, a temple, a secular library, whatever, you know, humanist meetup group, wherever it is, we find tribes. But the Buddha really was interested in a particular type of person. He calls this wise association. He said, we want to hang out with people that are interested in this shit, human suffering and how to alleviate it. And he said that there are lots of people out in the world, he said, with a lot of dust in their eyes. He calls this perpetual wandering, just kind of like jumping from one thing to the next, trying to find some refuge in the temporary pleasures of the world. And he said, those things aren't bad, the pleasures of the world, the pleasant sights and smells and tastes and feelings and thoughts and all those things, sure, they're great, but we try to find refuge or security in things that just don't last. They're temporary. And so he says, we want to associate with these people that are interested in something more out of life. He said, if you find no one to support you on the spiritual path, walk alone. If you see a wise person who steers you away from the wrong path, follow them. The company of the wise is joyful, like reunion with one's family. Therefore, live among the wise who are understanding, patient, responsible, and noble. Keep their company like the moon moving among the stars. You know, and the interesting thing is this characteristic of our life, impermanence is king, that the faces of the people change. You know, the group changes. The people that are sitting here today won't be the people sitting here, you know, won't all be the people sitting here in a few years. You know, and so the emphasis is just on connecting and finding a wise counsel and finding, you know, support and taking refuge in that support. There's an interesting study, forget who did it, but say there are these kind of three categories of people that we all have. And there's the, they just labeled them A, B, and C people. And the A people are usually one or two people that are incredibly close to you. They're in your inner circle, usually a spouse, partner, could be a parent. The B people are close friends that know pretty much everything about you. Maybe you don't see them every day or around them every day, but they're intimately aware of the suffering in your life. And the C people are all the acquaintances, people that you know and maybe have parts of yourself and know things about you and even maybe know struggles, but that maybe don't know you so in depth. And in this study, it's interesting, the people, who do you guys think are the people that are the most important, the A, the B, or the C? The B. That's right. The B people, not having one or two, but having, they say, about five or six people that know us intimately. And that, I like this because I'm a big map person. I don't have five or six people at all times. Sometimes I have too many people in my B. You know, but it's an interesting thing to think about. It's like kind of this idea of tribe, you know, how we used to live. There's a really great book named, I think it's called Sapiens, that a guy wrote on kind of our development and evolutionary biology, talks about how we're wired to, you know, kind of work in partnership with small groups. And this is the Sangha. The other two refuges are the Buddha and the Dharma. And so taking refuge in the Buddha means, if the Buddha means awakening, it means actually taking refuge in our potential for awakening. That we all have the seeds, that we all have the fertilizer, right? We all have the field of awakening in our heart, in our mind. You know, and again, tying to neuroscience, we have neuroplasticity. We can actually change and alter our genetics. You know, but in the spiritual sense, yeah, maybe if you dive in, but taking refuge in the Buddha is this high aspiration. Maybe this is all I get, this life. This life is what I get. I was born here. I got this precious opportunity to hear the Dharma, to practice mindfulness. I want to commit my life to this awakening for the benefit of myself and others. So Buddha, I like to just kind of talk about that as potential, taking refuge in potential, my potential. And Sangha, I like to think of that as taking refuge in people. And Dharma, I like to think of that as taking refuge in path. So potential, path, and people. And the path means that, you know, we have a map. You know, we have some guidance. We have this eightfold path. We have, you know, some landmarks that the Buddha gave us, thankfully. You know, he was a very chill bro. He was a very liberal guy. He was like, hey, man, whatever, you know. Be a Christian, be a Jew, be whatever you're born into, that's fine. Basically, be a good person, look at your mind, you know, try to help others. Kind of his message. But fortunately, he said, well, you know, and if you need some support, if you need some kind of guidelines, if you want to look at a map of ways of keeping yourself accountable, accountability is key here, here's this Eightfold Path. View, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, concentration. Here are some areas, some fields that you can bring your attention into and practice. We can have faith in the path. You know, we say it all the time, trust in the process. And give yourself to the process. There's something about giving oneself. There's this like egolessness of, and this humility of turning ourselves over, of letting go and saying, you know, that's an important, you know, aspect of this path is letting go, renunciation, not needing anything extra, giving up. And mindfulness, really the Dharma, is so much more subtractive in a lot of ways than it is additive. We teach it in the Western world. It's funny. We really teach this kind of productive aspect of mindfulness. It's like another thing to add to your day for performance and for focus and for stress relief. And so you're better in your communications and you're better at time management. And yeah, all those things are true. But really, mindfulness is all about giving up. When the thought comes into the mind, it says, oh shit, I got to plan for next week. You get to make the decision to look at the mind, you know, and to tell the mind, hey, not right now. We're not doing that right now. And the mind's urgency and insistence and persistence, and it, but you're going to forget. And it's clinging in the mind and just saying, hey, just let it go. Now, right now is not the time. And to let go means literally to release our hold on something. And so if I'm wandering through this life that has birth, aging, and sickness, and death, and this vulnerability, and this instability, and this uncertainty to it, what I'm doing is a lot of holding on to get through. And I hold on to a lot of the wrong things. I hold on to a lot of things that feel good and, you know, help me feel good quick, that feel very intense. You know, and so if I'm to let go of those things, well, what do I do? How do I find my balance? And we do that through community, and we do that by taking a path and committing to it, and we do that by believing we have the potential to walk it until the end, even if there is no end. Just go in that direction. They call the Dharma the groundless ground. It's like, you know, it's something that we can rely on in the midst of the ever-changing vicissitudes, the winds of life, the pleasure and the pain, and the joy and the sorrow, and the beauty and the tragedy, and the gain and the loss, and the ups and the downs. Those things are not going to stop this lifetime. They're here. They're coming. And so as we, you know, ride the waves, the ups and the downs, as we experience tragedy and loss, we have community and we have path and we have our potential. We have faith. And we connect with simple ritual. Maybe our ritual is just coming here. You know, maybe it's I like to sit 10 minutes in the morning after I take my shower and have a coffee. That's a nice ritual. You know, maybe I like to have an image of the Buddha in my house, or maybe I like to do some of the chanting. You know, maybe that speaks to me. Maybe I light incense and I set an intention for the day. Maybe I pray to God. I don't care what it is or who it is or how it is, because it's the intention. So I just want to read this and we'll kind of open it up. I'd love to hear everyone else's thoughts on faith. This is from Sharon Salzberg in her book, Faith. She says, I want to invite a new use of the word faith, one that is not associated with a dogmatic religious interpretation or divisiveness. I want to encourage delight in the word to help reclaim faith as fresh, vibrant, intelligent, and liberating. This is a faith that emphasizes a foundation of love and respect for ourselves. It is a faith that uncovers our connection to others rather than designating anyone as separate and apart. Faith does not require a belief system, and it is not necessarily connected to a deity or a god, though it doesn't deny one. This faith is not a commodity that we can either have or don't have. It's an inner quality that unfolds as we learn to trust our own deepest experience. The Buddha said faith is the beginning of all good things. No matter what we encounter in life, it is faith that enables us to try again, trust again, and love again. Even in times of immense suffering, it is faith that enables us to relate to the present moment in such a way that we can go on. We can move forward instead of becoming lost in resignation or despair. Faith links our present-day experience, whether wonderful or terrible, to an underlying pulse of life itself. A capacity for this type of faith is inherent in every human being. We might not yet recognize it or know how to nurture it, but we can learn how to do both.